From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. A couple of years ago, Poe Bronson wrote an article for New York Magazine about how parents should not talk to their children. He wrote that parents who praise their kids, figuring that praise builds self-esteem and that self-esteem leads to achievement, have got it wrong. Bronson cited research that shows that praise actually undermines kids. Well, now, Poe Bronson has expanded on that article in a book of new thinking about children. It's called Nurture Shock. He wrote it with Ashley Merriman, and Poe Bronson joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
It's an honor to be on. Thanks, Robert.
You mention in this book that you are learning with some difficulty to withhold praise from your own kids. I'd like you to explain first why you're convinced they're better off that way, and what's an example of it.
Children today hear so much praise that they've decoded its real meaning. We're making a mistake in thinking that we can manipulate them without recognizing that manipulation is at hand. So the research is clear that children only under the age of 7 take praise at face value, and after that period of time, they learn the pattern. Kids who are praised a lot are the kids who teachers and parents are worried about. Therefore, to hear praise is really a sign that mama is worried about you. When I first encountered the research on praise, I was coaching a kindergarten soccer team. My son was on the team. And until that point, I was telling the kids constantly, "You're great, you're doing well," even when they were dribbling the wrong way on the field or they dribbled the ball right off the field onto some other team's field. And when I read the research, I was like, I have to change here. And it wasn't so easy. So I started by just praising the kids for, "Wow, you noticed the ball was out of bounds and you stopped. Good job on that." Or, "Way to go in the right direction."
You learned to say something that the kids would receive as accurate and therefore sincere and truthful.
Right. And over time, I learned to let kids develop their own judgment about how well they had done. And when kids fail and all we do is praise them, there's a lot of duplicity in that. And kids begin to hear, nothing matters to my parents more than me doing great or me being smart. And failure becomes almost a taboo topic, something that families can't even mention.
And the main arena that you're looking at here is not childhood sports, it's school performance. And that is where praise that kids can see through, according to the researchers you cite, is not just of no good use, it's actually undermining.
Kids who are praised a lot become obsessed with the image of looking smart, so they tend to not want to take academic risks. And the worst consequence is that they make this conclusion: I should be getting by on my natural gifts. Therefore, to show other kids I'm working hard would be to broadcast that I'm not naturally smart, when in fact, in real life, you can't get anywhere without not just some intelligence, but also a lot of effort and persistence.
Now, praise is just one chapter, the subject of just one chapter in your book. You also address the question, why kids lie? Why do children lie?
All kids lie. Almost all kids will experiment with lying at least by the age of 4. And if they start when they're younger, you might think, oh no, my kid's lacking morality. Actually, it's a sign of their nascent intelligence because it's more complicated to hold in your head as a child the truth and an alternative reality and then try to sustain that alternative reality.
Lying, you're saying, is an exercise in creativity in that sense.
And it's normative. We should expect all children to attempt lying. The question is, what do we do with it over time? Kids who do not have it conditioned out of them by the age of 7 will tend to have habituated to lying as a way to deal with situations that are stressful or you're going to make people unhappy. And if you don't condition it out of them, they tend to hang on to it as a habit.
Have you found yourself changing the way that you deal with your own young children in terms of their lying?
Oh, certainly. We've done some online polling, and I agreed with the 75% before I'd done all this research that I needed to really emphasize to my kids that lying was wrong and I would sort of threaten them with punishments. Well, it turns out that increasing the threat of punishment only turns kids into better and more frequent liars. And what I've learned to do is to tell my children in that moment when I think that they might lie, I'll pause them and I'll say, "Look, you'll make me really happy if you tell me the truth." It's awkward to say it, but it does work and keeps kids from learning the habit of lying in difficult circumstances.
Yes, the way you describe it, lying for small children is often a way of keeping one's parents happy. The child thinks, my parent really wishes that I didn't do something in the first place. If I say I didn't, then that's my best chance of making my parent happy.
That's exactly right. And so we need to clearly signal to them what is the way to truly make us happy.
Then you return to the subject of lying when you write about adolescents. And there's one study you report on in which out of 36 potential topics, you found that the average teenager lies to her or his parents on about 12 of them. And there's a list here. Teens lie about what they spend their allowance on, whether they've started dating, what clothes they put on away from the house. They lie about what movie they went to. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. How do researchers now understand adolescence that's different from before?
Well, 78% of American parents think that their teenagers can tell them anything. But the teens completely disagree, because while the average teen might be lying to their parents about 12 of the 36 common topics, even the teens who lie the least are still lying. They're lying about 5 topics out of the 36. Parents today imagine that there's a trade-off between being strict and being permissive, and that the benefit of some permissiveness is honesty, that you're going to hear the truth and not be kept in the dark, so you'll be able to help. The science says that those permissive parents do not hear more truth from their kids. And the best way to hear truth from kids is to set a few rules, consistently enforce them, and then this is one that's going to sound controversial, Robert, parents who negotiate occasionally with their teens. We need to see that some arguing with parents, a moderate amount of arguing, is actually a good thing, not a bad thing. That arguing is a sign of respect, not of disrespect.
How is arguing a sign of respect?
Because to the teenager, they have two choices, telling you the truth and leading to an argument, or just outright lying. Arguing over the actual rules is a better alternative and a very different thing than arguing over your authority as a parent to set rules at all.
Poe Bronson, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Robert. I really appreciate it.
So Poe Bronson is the author, with Ashley Merriman, of the book Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children.
Energy sprawl is one of the reasons that Time magazine's senior correspondent Michael Grunwald is dubious of biofuels.
It originally sounded like a terrific idea. Renewable fuels is one of those phrases that's become like the troops or apple pie. How can you be against it?
Grunwald has written an article in Foreign Policy magazine entitled 7 Myths About Alternative Energy. Biofuels dump less carbon into the air, but if your biofuel was grown on a farm and somebody burned down a forest to make room for the field, he says that cancels much of the benefit. Grunwald is skeptical about another alternative fuel, nuclear energy.
The sort of old line on nuclear power was that it's expensive to build, but, you know, it's really cheap to operate. So overall, it's kind of a good way to provide power without emissions. The problem is it's turning out to be really, really, really expensive to build. And so the numbers just aren't working out.
Although, is that really a problem? I mean, you yourself point out that France gets 80% of its power, electric power, from nuclear fuel, and that doesn't seem to have bankrupted France.
It's great that we already have the nuclear power that we have. I'm glad we did it 30 years ago. The problem is right now, we really need the emissions fixes that are going to provide the most bang for our buck. The cheapest way of reducing our emissions is through efficiency. More efficient refrigerators, more efficient air conditioners, more efficient light bulbs.
Let me ask about that, because on the surface, that sounds like a very valid argument. Anybody can understand that a more fuel-efficient car uses less oil. But earlier this year, we were talking with a Canadian economist named Jeff Rubin, who looked into the numbers on this, and he basically argued that efficiency is not as useful as you might think. Let's listen.
Efficiency in car engines have improved by about 30%. Yet, your average American driver consumes just as much gasoline as he or she did 30 years ago. because the cost of driving has fallen, and we've consumed those efficiency gains in ever more consumption. Efficiency can only lead to conservation if we don't allow the price to fall.
Michael Grunwald?
Well, I guess the first response is just imagine what would have happened to the amount of gasoline we would have used if we hadn't had those efficiency gains. Economies change in slow ways, and right now we have an economy that's set up for people to use their cars. Perhaps you'll drive slightly more if your car is more efficient. Basically, you're still going to have to go to the store. And the difference of whether your car is getting 40 miles per the gallon or 20 miles per gallon is going to make a really big difference.
Although you touch on another interesting point that you make, you argue that people may have to fundamentally change their behavior.
That's right. I mean, I think the way to start reducing emissions is pretty simple. We need to start using more efficient cars that use less gasoline, and we need more efficient appliances and factories and light bulbs that use less power. And then at the same time, we're also going to have to drive a little less. That might mean, you know, subsidies for carpooling and telecommuting and mass transit and freight rail. These are sort of tweaks around the edges that can really provide incredible gains for the changes we need to make right now.
I'm sorry to need to challenge some of the more reassuring modifiers you put in there, using a little bit less energy or making some tweaks around the edges. When I think about a world population of 6 billion people that is going up to 9 billion people over the next few decades, when I think about developing nations that are going to create more and more industry, use more and more energy, when scientists start doing the numbers on that and they try to figure out a way to actually reduce our total amount of carbon output, given all those pressures to use more energy, they find that we have to make monumental changes in the amount of energy that every individual uses.
Well, let me give you the example of California and the Pacific Northwest, which is different from the rest of the country in that their utilities have an incentive to help people save energy. They don't just make more money when you buy more energy. And that changed in the 70s. And what you find is California and the Pacific Northwest, over the last three decades, per capita energy use has been absolutely flat. And in the rest of the country, it's increased 50%. So just that one change made a 50% difference.
That's an amazing statistic, but even flat doesn't get you anywhere near an 80% reduction.
Well, there's still a lot more that needs to be done nationwide. And that's why you're going to need more efficiency mandates for server farms and computers and plasma TVs and things that we weren't thinking about 30 years ago. But ultimately, you know, when people see the kind of not particularly expensive changes that can be made without dramatically overturning our lifestyles, reason will win out.
Michael Grunwald is a senior correspondent for Time magazine. He wrote in Foreign Policy magazine about what he sees as myths about alternative energy. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
I am baffled by Colonel Gaddafi's behavior in giving a hero's welcome to the one man convicted in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 in 1988.
Senior news analyst Daniel Shore.
Abdel Basset el-Megrahi, a former Libyan intelligence agent, was released from a Scottish prison on representation that he's dying of cancer. He flew to Tripoli to be met in an organized rally of hundreds. The honoring of a convicted mass killer has been denounced by President Obama and especially by families of the 270 who were killed in the crash in Lockerbie, Scotland. It looks to them like an endorsement of terrorism after Gaddafi has spent a decade trying to shed his terrorist image. In these 10 years, he has scrapped Libya's nuclear program, he shelled out close to $2 billion in compensation to Lockerbie families, and sought the reopening of diplomatic relations with the United States and others as a token of improved relations. The Libyan leader was due to receive an official visit by Britain's Duke of York, and in prospect was a meeting with President Obama during the United Nations Assembly in September. None of that is happening. Although al-Megrahi was a Gaddafi intelligence officer, the Libyan leader has never personally acknowledged any connection with the bombing. The closest he came was in an interview with journalist Milton Vios in 1999. Asked about his connection with the conspiracy, he said, "I can't answer as to whether Libya was responsible." Al-Megrahi has never implicated Gaddafi. Gaddafi has now clasped him to his bosom, apparently willing to defy worldwide condemnation. As to why Gaddafi is willing to risk the fruits of 10 years of courting the West, Some analysts believe he may be responding to Libyan public opinion, although public opinion has not seemed to bother him in the past. Or does Gaddafi need to keep his former intelligence officer quiet? As I say, I am baffled. This is Daniel Shore.
We used to say that a picture is worth a thousand words, but that was back in the analog era. A digital image is worth several thousand after you Photoshop it a few times. The latest instance of this is a Microsoft ad which shows three people seated at a conference table taking in a PowerPoint demonstration with such gleeful smiles on their faces you'd think they're actually watching Madagascar 2 or something like that. On the right is a woman in a business suit who's wielding the clicker. On the left is an Asian man, white shirt, no tie, collar open. And between them is a black man, looking like the oldest and most senior, certainly most formally dressed executive in the room. Across the picture is the text, "Empower your people with the IT tools they need." Next comes the Microsoft Poland version of the same ad as it went viral yesterday. Same woman, same Asian man. But instead of the black exec, there's a white man with the very same suit, same shirt, same tie, same wristwatch, even the same black wrist, just a white head for the overwhelmingly white Polish market. Microsoft says today, "We're looking into the details of this situation. We apologize and have replaced the image with the original photograph." Well, joining us is Hani Farid, who's professor of computer science at Dartmouth College. And Professor Farid, first, how common, from what you've seen, is this sort of swapping out of heads to make a different racial impression in a picture online?
It's surprisingly common, in fact. And in fact, the notion of swapping out heads dates back all the way to the 1800s when somebody did it to a photograph of Abraham Lincoln. The University of Wisconsin at Madison got in trouble a while back when they spliced in a black head into a sea of white heads to show more racial diversity. And just earlier this year, Fun Guide of Toronto did the same thing to try to increase the racial diversity of a cover of their magazine. So it seems to be a fairly common manipulation, in fact.
Yes, those were both instances of trying to create greater diversity, as opposed to this case, creating a little bit less diversity.
Right. It seems to be an equal opportunity Photoshop manipulation.
Now, you're working on software that would be able to detect images that have been manipulated.
That's correct. And in fact, in this particular image of the Microsoft ad, there was a glaring error that they made, well, in addition to the black hand and the white face, and that is the lighting on the face is completely wrong. So if you look at the middle person, the white head that was spliced in, it's clear that the lighting is coming from his right. But if you look at the other two people in the room, there's no such dominant light in there. And one of the very powerful tools that we've developed is one that looks at lighting inconsistencies to determine whether something has been manipulated.
As you said, there is a rich history to manipulating photographs. And there was a wonderful book a few years ago, The Commissar Vanishes, about the Soviet practice of eliminating people who'd been politically eliminated from all the images in which they'd appeared.
That's right.
But does this strike you as a different order of effectiveness, what can now be done with digital images?
I think the difference is twofold today. One is that the tools to manipulate photographs are now available to nearly everybody. And the other thing is the ability to distribute this material widely and quickly. And those two things have combined to have fundamentally changed our relationship with digital imagery.
Well, Professor Farid, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for your time.
That is Hani Farid, who is professor of computer science at Dartmouth College.
One of the people channeling what he calls public anxiety is former Congressman Dick Armey of Texas. He was a leading figure in the 1990s when Republicans won control of Congress and defeated President Clinton's health care plan. Today, he's chairman of FreedomWorks, a conservative advocacy group. His group has organized opposition to Democrats at those town hall meetings this summer.
When members of Congress call town hall meetings, we encourage our residents in that congressional district to attend the meetings. We also help them to clarify what are the precise focus of the question you might want to zero in on. And we have always consistently, as a matter of good manners and good strategy, encouraged our folks to always go there and make a good presentation of themselves, well-mannered and courteous, because, in fact, if you go to a town hall meeting and you make a display of yourself, you're likely to not get called upon. We don't encourage any display of bad manners.
Well, that's interesting. What do you think of some of the more dramatic town hall meetings, the rambunctious town hall meetings that there have been this summer?
Well, they've been pretty dang colorful. A couple of things. One, people have gone to the town hall meeting with an enormous sense of anxiety. And I think one of the initial aggravations that I think I heard expressed consistently in town hall after town hall as I looked at the news coverage was, I've come here as a serious adult worried about what is the substance of this bill, and you're talking down to me like I'm a child and I resent it. So I think that the source of the anger was that the congressional members did not take their constituents serious as well-informed and seriously concerned persons.
Although let's be frank, I mean, there were people who showed up after receiving emails instructing them to interrupt the town hall meeting at the first opportunity. There were a few instances where people have been around town hall meetings with firearms. I mean, they weren't talked down to by their members. They showed up with firearms.
I don't know of anybody that is instructing their members to go and be disrupted. If there's an organization out there that does that, it's an organization that is not very competent in my estimation. I mean, it doesn't make sense to tell your members and associates, go to the town hall meeting and make a spectacle of yourself. That's just plain poor strategy.
I don't want to make you predict the future. Well, actually, I suppose I do, because you've seen a lot in your long career. And as you look at this health care debate, you've got a president who's committed to a certain kind of change, although he said he's willing to do some negotiating. You've got folks on your side who are passionately against it. You've got corporate interests all over the place. How do you think all this ends?
Well, first of all, I find very few corporate interests that aren't already in bed with Obama, but it's pretty much gotten to be a direct contest between the real voters in the real world and the real office holders who are privileged to represent them. And
I'm sorry, are you saying that supporters of the president are not real voters?
No. They've got real voters on their side. They've got real voters too. But the fact of the matter is, the pollsters will tell you there's something about the intensity level. Half of the Democrat voters that voted for Obama are half embarrassed and apologetic about this big government imposition. They don't have a great deal of intensity in the support for their program by real voters out there. And the intensity of the opposition is extremely intense. So the long and the short of it is, any member of Congress who votes for this program, as we see it now in the bills reported out of committee, has to give serious consideration to whether or not that vote and that vote in and of itself will be the vote that prevents me from being reelected.
Mr. Armey, pleasure talking with you again.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dick Armey is a former Republican congressman who now leads the conservative advocacy group Freedom Works. And you can follow all the twists in the overhaul debate, twists and turns, I should say, in our Prescriptions for Change series at npr.org/health. Let's return to the United States now, where we have spent part of this summer sampling what's available at some of America's farmers markets. And today we'll explore a vegetable that looks like a kind of albino carrot on steroids. It's not a carrot, not a turnip, it's a radish. Tina Antolini from WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, tells us about the daikon.
Compared to the usual cute, rosy radishes, Michael Burns says daikon looks a little bit like an alien.
It's a long, white radish, sometimes as big as your arm, sometimes as big as your leg. Apparently, that's how they grow it in Japan. We find that our customers maybe like it a little bit smaller than leg size.
Burns standing in the daikon field where he works. The one he's holding reaches from his fingertips to his elbow, not counting a top of vibrant green leaves. Burns' boss, Kazu Yoshimoto, says the daikon's size is what gives it its name.
The literal translation is fat root.
When Yoshimoto came here from Japan to start Sunbow 5 Foundation Farm, daikon was a must among his crops. Raw, he says, it gives you more oomph than your typical radish.
Regular radish, maybe more mild, soft, you know, gentle to you, but daikon radish, like beating you or fighting you, like a little bit sharp. They have lots of energy, more, we call it ki. Ki means spirit or soul.
So the daikon has lots of soul.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Cooked, he says, it can be more mild and sweet and can go into anything from stir fries to soups. The easiest way to enjoy daikon is just slicing it up.
I'm peeling off the skin. Skin's a little bit, you know, hard.
And dipping it into a little bit of miso paste.
Now you eat it.
Well, this sort of salty sweetness of the miso is really nice with the spicy daikon. The heat kind of blooms in your mouth at the end.
Some of that heat is tempered when Yoshimoto makes the traditional daikon pickle called takwan. It tastes almost like Korean kimchi with a satisfying crunch. It's made by burying sun-dried daikon in a bucket of salt for months. And when selling it at the farmer's market, Yoshimoto says slices of takwan are a little bit more approachable than a daikon the size of your arm. For NPR News, I'm Tina Antolini in Western Massachusetts.
You can explore the rest of our Farm Fresh series at the new NPR.org, where you can also find recipes and share your own.